Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 18 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, if it weren't for William Shatner, Steve, I'd say you might not be eligible to become an astronaut. But hey, John Glenn flew on the shuttle at the age of 77, and Shatner himself was actually 90 years old when he took a ride on a suborbital trip aboard Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin. So that's right, today's topic is all about the right stuff for a trip off this dusty old planet of ours. But first, let's get to this week's updates, and we each have one that pertains to trips to the lunar surface. I'm going to go first, Steve. China's space agency seems to be gearing up for a spectacular mission that will launch hopefully in May of this year. And Steve, this is a big one. Now, what we do know is that the scientists that are working on the mission have recently been giving up their family reunions and celebrations that are linked to the Lunar New Year to get ready for this launch. It's a mission to send a spacecraft to the surface of the moon, but wait, there's more. It's going to gather lunar material and return it to the Earth with the arrival pegged for sometime later this summer. Now, this would obviously be a first for any country, and a dramatic demonstration of the Chinese space program's abilities. Now, so what are we looking at? It's a 53-day mission on the lunar surface. They hope to dig up about 2 kilograms of lunar materials. What do they do after they've gotten those 2 kilograms of lunar materials? They load that material onto an ascent vehicle. They then send that up to rendezvous with the orbiting service module, which then brings itself back to Earth orbit. Prior to re-entry, a capsule is emitted from the service module, which will then enter a fiery re-entry into our atmosphere and eventually parachute down to the Earth's surface. And what's different about all this, Steve, is because we know we've seen rocks before, this material would be coming from the far side of the moon. So can you top that one?
I've got one which probably isn't familiar with many listeners, and that's to do with a private American company called Intuitive Machines. And it has 3 NASA contracts under the space agency's Commercial Lunar Payload Services, shortly called CLPS, and that's to deliver payloads to the lunar surface. And by the time that this episode airs, as we speak, Tim, the spacecraft called Odysseus has been launched atop a SpaceX Falcon 9 from Cape Canaveral, and it's scheduled to land near the South Pole around February 22nd, and they're taking almost a direct high-velocity orbit to the moon. Now, the goal is to carry 6 NASA payloads and 5 commercial payloads, 11 in all, and some of the NASA instruments include tools to study how the landing itself produces plumes of moon dust. You may remember that Buzz Aldrin said, "Picking up a little dust here," to Neil Armstrong during their first descent. And it's also carrying a device to measure radio waves and how those affect the lunar surface. Interestingly, the commercial payloads include a camera that's going to be tossed off the lander just before it touches down. And that camera is going to take photographs of the landing. In addition, there's 125 tiny sculptures by the American artist Jeff Koons and a chip designed to establish an archive of human knowledge on the moon. So that's all kind of strange and wonderful, too.
You know, I think there have been other attempts, Steve, by private companies to land on the moon. Israel's Space IL and Japan's iSpace, but they both crash-landed and they were destroyed, so that's disappointing.
There have been astronauts training for space flight for more than 60 years now, and we're going to be talking about the right stuff for them. And while there's been changes in what author Tom Wolfe once described as the right stuff, those changes have not really been much of a surprise to us. So for the past few years, we've seen five countries work together to train astronauts and cosmonauts to work on board the ISS. And those countries have been Russia, Japan, Canada, the European Space Agency, and the United States. And they've hosted the training program. And each year, that means about 30 to 40 candidates have been trained. And a little sidebar here, Tim. You know, I remember one phase of my dad's fighter pilot career during the Cold War era, and he was training both Canadian and NATO jet pilots while we were stationed at Portage in Manitoba. So jump ahead a few years to when we were now based at Marville in France, where he flew interceptors. And one weekend, we took a trip to Eindhoven, Holland. And while walking past an outdoor cafe, a number of Dutch pilots recognized him, and a joyful reunion occurred. Now, the point of all this is, reading the annals of past and current international astronaut training regimes, I know that this same kind of cross-border respect continues, and that can only mean good things for international space relationships.
Brotherhoods are formed, for sure. Now, not surprisingly, the original recruitment by NASA was for military personnel with flight experience. They were looking for men that were small enough to fit into those tiny space vehicles, and of course, young enough to be in peak physical condition. By comparison, I'm pretty sure we know that William Shatner was none of those things. He flew at the age of 90. Now, of course, the notion of being a test pilot was thought by NASA to be pretty much what they needed to fly a rocket into space, and I suppose it made sense. The training was going to be different, but as a job description, learning to fly a spacecraft seemed to be just an extension of learning to fly a plane faster or higher. But what about women in space? It would actually take a generation for NASA to formalize plans and train women and add them to the space program. That recruitment program started in 1978. And for the political folks listening today, the Equal Rights Amendment, which would ban gender discrimination in the United States, is still yet to become law. Now, it did pass the requirements at both the federal and state levels, finally, by the year 2020. But hey, that was the year that Donald Trump took office, and he declined to move the amendment forward. Surprise, surprise. On the other hand, the Russians were recruiting women in the early 1960s, and Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman to fly in space in 1963.
I did a little research on Tereshkova and noted that, counterintuitively, the women's cosmonaut training program actually began before the men's course.
So that seems a little strange, obviously, from a chronological standpoint or point of view. Obviously, the males were flown before women. So what was going on there, Steve?
It was never the Soviet intent to have a woman in space first. That position was predetermined to be a man, but they wanted to make sure that they had a woman in space before the Americans. After Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space in 1961, Nikolai Kamenin, the Soviet director of cosmonaut training, read in the American media that female pilots were training to be astronauts. Now, in hindsight, we know that's not really the case. However, in his diary, he wrote, quote, "We can't allow the first woman in space to be an American. This would be an insult to the patriotic feelings of Soviet women." And approval was granted to place five female cosmonauts in the next group, and they began training in 1963. Since there were no Soviet women fighter pilots, as compensation, the Soviets required potential candidates to be experienced parachutists, in addition to the typical physical restrictions of being less than 30 years old, shorter than 5'7", and less than 155 pounds in weight.
Now I understand that these candidates were civilians with no flying experience, but they had to have this experience with being a parachutist. What's behind that, Steve?
Well, unknown to the West for decades after the first Soviet orbital successes, the cosmonauts didn't land with their spacecraft. At that time, the Soviets lacked the technology to safely land a capsule and cosmonauts, so they went with Plan B, which was to have the cosmonauts parachute out of the descending capsule. And this was kept a secret, as international rules stipulated that in order to count, shall we say, as a space mission, the cosmonaut had to be in the capsule when it landed.
So Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman to fly in space on June 16, 1963, commanding Vostok 5 for 48 orbits. As planned, she ejected from the capsule, like you said, Steve, 7 kilometers above the Earth. her parachute shrouds almost tangled during extreme buffeting during her descent, but her acquired skills actually did prevent her from getting into serious trouble. To this date, she remains the only woman to have flown solo in space, and at the age of 26 years of age, also the youngest. In this single flight, she logged more flight time than the combined times of all American astronauts who had flown before that date.
And just for the record, though she flew only once in space, she married a cosmonaut, and 1 year after her space flight, gave birth to a daughter, and that daughter became the first person in the history of the Earth whose parents had both traveled into space.
Tereshkova added her academic credentials to the portfolio she had, graduating with honors from the Air Force Engineering Academy in October of 1969. And by 1976, she was a colonel in the Soviet Air Forces. And although she did not go to space again, she remained an instructor at the Yuri Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center.
And making a quick reference now to the American space program, I'd hazard a guess that most people got their opinions of the early Mercury astronauts from the Right Stuff movie released in 1983. And later, Mercury astronaut Wally Schirra was asked about the accuracy of that movie and its depiction of those early years of spaceflight. And he said that the movie was basically Animal House in space and nothing like the real world. Oh well, Tim, that's hardly the first time or the last that Hollywood is going to play with our emotions and wallets by emphasizing fiction over science.
Well, in those early years, nobody really knew, you know, what to expect. You had the great uncertainty of how mechanical systems might work differently in microgravity, and certainly the unknown were the forces that might be exerted on astronauts during reentry. So there really was nothing but speculation as to how the human body would manage itself hurtling around the Earth in a small tin can. And trying out primates, after that dogs, well, then why not test pilots? You could see the logic. NASA enlisted astronauts in April of 1959, and it would be just over 2 years until Alan Shepard became the first American to fly in space, albeit on a suborbital mission that lasted 15 minutes and 22 seconds. So 2 years of training for that.
Well, you know, I certainly remember seeing film clips of astronauts being trained in centrifuge machines, spinning a person around in all manner of directions and at great speed, too. However, you know, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention Canada's contribution to pilot training and centrifuges. Way back in 1941, the first human centrifuge in the Allied countries was pioneered by Canadian Dr. Wilbur R. Frank. And his centrifuge machine was used to pioneer and create the world's first anti-G flying suits. So, hooray for Canada. But going back to NASA, and one of the astronauts to come closest to passing out at a critical time during high G maneuvers in space was none other than Neil Armstrong. He and Dave Scott were aboard Gemini 8 when a docking procedure went literally sideways due to a malfunctioning thruster. And the wildly spinning craft almost caused the crew to lose consciousness, and that would have been fatal until Armstrong managed to bring this spin under control. Interestingly, though none the worse for wear, they ironically did suffer sickness, seasickness, as their capsule bobbed in the ocean for about 3 hours before they were picked up.
Sometime later, one of the great U.S. astronauts, Dr. Peggy Whitson, who is still flying, I might add, flew on the ISS way back in 2002 and later was twice commander of the ISS. And she holds the record for the number of days in space by any American. Steve, she left NASA and she's currently a hired gun, if you will, astronaut for Axiom. So setting that aside, in 2008, during her return after a six-month mission as commander of ISS, she and a South Korean female astronaut, along with a Russian male astronaut, were aboard a Soyuz return capsule. A malfunction took place during the descent, causing the Soyuz to enter what's known as a steep ballistic reentry. Doesn't sound good. And it resulted in some violent tumbling and 8 Gs of force for over a minute during its fiery 23-minute descent and subsequent very rough landing.
And to literally add insult to injury, Tim, Anatoly Permanov, the head of the Russian Federal Space Agency, speculated that the ballistic reentry was connected to the Russian nautical superstition that having more women than men on a craft was unlucky. He then further added, "This isn't discrimination. I'm just saying that when a majority is female, sometimes certain kinds of unsanctioned behavior or something else occurs." And he concluded by saying that he would try to ensure that the number of women would not exceed the number of men in the future. Talk about blatant chauvinism.
Good for you for tracking that down. Now, fortunately, in general, incidents such as these have been quite rare. And now you have to compare that to the far more frequent challenges that astronauts do come up against. And I'm not sure if any amount of screening or training would have helped identify which astronauts were going to be subject to these sorts of problems. Steve, do you know what they are?
I think we're talking about space adaptation syndrome, which we all know better as space sickness. Now, due to the lack of gravity, which orients the fluids within our inner ear, some astronauts are prone to becoming disoriented. And research indicates that around 60 to 80% of all astronauts and cosmonauts experience symptoms of space sickness during their first few days of microgravity. And those symptoms can include nausea, vomiting, disorientation, and headaches. The severity and duration of space sickness varies greatly from person to person.
You know, some notable astronauts suffer space sickness are surprising. John Glenn, back in 1962. Neil Armstrong felt nauseous in his 1969 flight to the moon. Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, in her flight in 1983. And Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield during part of his time on the ISS. And it wasn't only astronauts who experienced space adaptation sickness. Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, experienced it as well in 1961, as did Valentina Tereshkova in her 63 flight. And here's another couple of health challenges that seem to fit in easily into this discussion. Skin rashes, after all, these astronauts are not getting a normal shower. They're wearing some exotic fabrics for extended periods of time, and the air, not so fresh. And a bit scarier on the health front is the risk of respiratory illness. I didn't find out information on the relative incidence of this kind of illness, and Steve, I'm pretty sure that after all these years, NASA knows a little bit more about this than they're willing to publish.
And I understand that to address skin rashes and other dermatological issues, astronauts receive training on skin care and hygiene practices tailored to the space environment. Additionally, space agencies continuously refine spacecraft design, clothing materials, and hygiene protocols to minimize the risk of skin problems during missions. Let's take a listen to one astronaut explaining how they actually prepared for the risks of illness on the ISS. Let's hear Colonel Luca Parmitano.
How do astronauts prevent colds or flus on the ISS, and what kind of remedies do you have? Do you bring your own medication? How does it work?
Well, first of all, colds and flus are either of a bacteriological origin or viral origin. So the first and foremost way of preventing it from happening is the quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why astronauts, before going to the space station, stay up to 21 days separated from, you know, the general carriers of bacteria and viruses, which is children, general population. We are usually segregated with a small group of people that are checked, and in a way they are in quarantine with us. And then on the space station, we try to keep it very aseptic. In theory, we shouldn't have viral agents traveling around. And after a couple of weeks, really, we all share the same bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of that also lowers the risk of infections and so on. If something should happen, depending on the gravity of it, of how serious it is, we have a small pharmacy, small but with lots of different antibiotics or medicine that you can find off the shelf, or even more serious things that we can take with the support of the medical staff on the ground. If we have a doctor on board, which we had, we can also use him and his expertise to, you know, for small maladies and things like that. And if something really serious should happen, we can always come back to the ground within a few hours.
It's really important to note that for low Earth orbit missions, the backup plan is a trip home. But what about the astronauts we may soon be sending back to the moon?
Yeah, back to the moon. This kind of reminds me of Ralph Cramden and his "To the Moon, Alice, to the Moon" line from the TV classic The Honeymooners. But let's go with the flow there and think about how astronaut requirements will change when our focus shifts away from low Earth orbit to longer flights, taking humans beyond the Earth's magnetosphere, which is protective, and far away enough that a medical emergency has to be solved in deep space. That could be Mars or the Moon. There's been plenty of doctors who have made flights to space stations over the past few decades, including Canada's Dr. Roberta Bondar. But those doctors were aboard to study human physiology and microgravity, not to perform appendectomies and other surgeries.
That's right, Steve. No surgery has been performed to date. Interestingly, the most serious non-fatal incident occurred on Apollo 13, and that was a urinary tract infection that befell poor astronaut Jack Swigert. Now, listeners, of course, should recall that Swigert was the last-minute replacement astronaut for Ken Mattingly, who'd been exposed to the measles, and the worry was he'd break out during the flight to the moon. Prior to the explosion that we all know from, of course, the movie Apollo 13, NASA was already working up developing plans and anticipating just what might have become a medical emergency for Swigert, with only some antibiotics on board the spacecraft. And that's just the point, Steve. Once we start talking about sending astronauts to work, live on the lunar surface, or orbit the moon for weeks or months at a time, well, the reality is that someone is going to get hurt or become sick or need serious medical attention. And while we're at it, a person's mental well-being might also take a turn while coping with living in such isolation.
There's a bit of push-pull dynamics going on here, Tim. Just as we've begun to normalize space travel by introducing space tourism and plans for space station orbiting the moon or SpaceX flights to Mars, we can't just set aside what we humans need to get by here on Earth. I can't imagine a future where enormous resources are being spent to launch just a few rare individuals to explore the universe on our behalf, all the while knowing there's no protection from radiation, no medical treatment for common injuries or illnesses, and no consideration for care in the event of psychological trauma. That wouldn't say much for the human guinea pigs, and even less about Earthbound mortals sending people to a near certain fate.
What we're describing, I think, is a moment in space travel that's fast approaching, but rarely discussed. At some point soon, the incremental evolution of space travel is going to fail us. In just a few years' time, Axiom, the private U.S. firm, they hope to be operating a privately funded space station in low Earth orbit, a profitable operation to take people to space for any number of reasons, for the ride, the view, to rent a movie production studio they're planning, or carry out research, fabricate specialty products. And of course, just how far down that path are we going to go until some medical crisis happens and someone dies? It's not a risk, it's a certainty. Or consider all of the countries and firms that are planning to set up shop on the lunar surface and start exploring or mining there. Steve, I'm suggesting that we compare the circumstance today with the one in North Carolina when the Wright brothers managed the first flight. For quite a while, back in those days, the plans were for slightly bigger planes, more powerful engines, you know, more durable wheels and so on. But, you know, fast forward a little bit, and they're talking about building and operating a modern airline as we see today. That's a whole other thing. And to conduct routine space operations is another giant leap in technology that's looking right at us.
And clearly, Tim, we're talking about a paradigm shift in astronaut training for long-duration spaceflight, not in low Earth orbit.
That's right. As it stands today, Steve, on board the ISS, they have a small quantity of pharmaceuticals. They do have some diagnostic tools. And, of course, they have access to ground control and the expertise here on Earth. But there's no facility on board for any kind of surgery. And should surgery be imperative, the patient would need to be transported home, going one step further to a moon-based situation without considering many other demands for long-term survivability, you know, oxygen, food, heat, energy. Just thinking about medical needs, imagine the obstacles for building and staffing a surgery in the lunar environment. And don't forget, there'd also be the follow-up gear that might be necessary. There's been an injury or what have you, the space astronaut needs physiotherapy or prosthetics, blood work that might be needed, or x-rays, MRIs, CT scans. I mean, seriously, Steve, it's just not viable to propose sending people to space in the 21st century and having them hobbled with 19th century medical care.
And there's also mental challenges to overcome. After all, humans are social beings and enjoy company, and we all know what happens to group dynamics in confined living conditions. Do we accept only future astronaut candidates who enjoy solitude and their own company and who have existing excellent health?
I don't know. I'd like to suggest the future of astronaut qualifications is actually going to be akin to the historical patterns of immigration. You know, initially, a few adventurous souls, or they set out to explore a new land. If they succeed, they're followed by people interested in exploiting economic opportunities. And here you can say the parallel is Elon Musk and SpaceX and the other companies like Axiom wanting to build for-profit space stations. Then comes a tide of settlers. But in space terms, that might be tourists. And we're seeing the first signs of that with Jeff Bezos and others sending up actors and athletes for sightseeing missions. Well, then you might fast forward to modern immigration policies here in Canada and say, well, we select people based on things like their education level or their wealth or their investment potential. And dare I say it, even family reunification. So Canada is now welcoming about 500,000 immigrants per year, and nearly double that number in terms of international students. Obviously, the infrastructure needed to make that happen is massive. And just as we experience the fallout from these challenges of such high immigration levels, well, now, that's the point. We're talking about in terms of the future of astronauts and the future there. We're going to be talking about building communities to house people on the moon or Mars or orbiting space stations.
You know, that sort of reminds me of the great book by Pierre Burton, The Last Spike. And that's a book I've read many times and annotated just out of great interest. Building that railway across the country came quickly on the heels of those first European explorers to cross the continent. The railway wasn't built by explorers, and those space-based communities aren't going to be built by test pilots.
Well, it's fun to think about how this is going to play out, but that's all the time we have for this episode. This is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, let me see what spring brings.